to introduce Drew Hansen. Drew is the author of The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr., and A Speech to Inspire the Nation. This copy will be on reserve in the library right around the corner all week. If you want to take a look at that, and just about purchasing when you get home, that would be great. So, Drew is state representative from which area in Washington?
Kitsap County.
Okay. Still doesn't help me much, but I know it helps everybody in the room. Okay, very good. Thank you. Drew also studied at Yale Law School, Harvard, and at Oxford. So pretty darn good credentials, I would say. So we so appreciate you here. He's doing a series on Martin Luther King Jr., and tonight it's going to focus on his spiritual life. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you very much.
Yay! I feel like this is the beginning of the Muppet Show. How many people know the Muppet Show? Okay, the Muppet Show begins, Kermit the Frog always goes in going, yeah! Everyone cheers, so I'll skip that part. Okay, thank you for coming. This is lovely of you to be here after eating 4,000 pounds of burritos, which is what I did. I am Drew Hansen. In normal life, I'm Representative Drew Hansen, where I've served in the Washington State House of Representatives since 2011. I'm here tonight because of this book that Holden was kind enough to put on reserve. It's called The Dream, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Speech That Inspired a Nation. It's about the I Have a Dream speech. And if you're interested in this after this week, you can look but not purchase the copy in the bookstore, I'm told, because there's like one of them. But you can get your local bookstore to order it because by some miracle, it is still in print. So that's very exciting. I grew up going to Holden, so this is my first time on the teaching faculty, but not my first time at Holden. I came to Holden every year as a kid with my parents, Wayne and Carolyn Hansen, who are right there. Okay, come to the front, applause. Yay! Sometimes with my aunt and uncle, Terry and Donna Lemke, who are
right over here.
Yay! And occasionally with my cousin, Cammy, who's now married to Matt, they have two kids up there. If you are not already a member of our family, just by being here tonight, you are constructively a member of our family, so welcome. We'll make sure you're on the list for the reunion next year.
Christmas cards too.
You're all on the Christmas card list. So my folks brought us here, of course, because this was, I mean, they wanted a Christian vacation, they also wanted a cheap vacation, and Holden nicely checked both of those boxes. And I loved it growing up, but I haven't been back here for 26 years. So, which is on me and not on anyone else. It's still taking me a little bit to get into the swing of Holden. We had a basket making class today, and it was my first basket. I think everyone else's first basket. And I get partway through my basket, and Debbie, who is also in the class, is making this awesome basket, right? And I said, man, Debbie, your basket's great. And our teacher, Ruth, who's very good at her job, says, everyone's basket is great. They're all different, and they're all great, which is such a Holden. And I knew I was not immediately in the Holden spirit, so I know, like I know God loves us, and we're all different, and God loves us just the way they are, but man, God loves Debbie Moore. Look at her basket. So I'm trying to get into the Holden spirit, but it's taking a little bit of time. But it's still, gosh, it really does feel exactly the same in so many ways as it did 26 years ago. We had a spiritual direction class this afternoon when someone said, you know, this place really feels like home. And for me, even just coming back, gosh, it really does feel like home. So it's lovely to be back home after so long. So tonight we are going to do the first part of a three-part series on the life and career of Martin Luther King. Tonight is the spiritual life of Dr. King. Dr. King as a Christian and as a preacher, as a man of faith. Wednesday is the civil rights career of Martin Luther King. So that is the career that you all know, at least in basic outline. Friday is Dr. King as a political figure and the role of Dr. King in the civil rights movement in some of the landmark statutory and constitutional achievements of the 1960s. This is sort of meant to be a series of three standalone sessions. So if you're only interested in the Christian-y stuff, you can come tonight and then bail on the next couple. If you have folks in the village who are not so into the Jesus-y stuff, they are not here tonight, they can come do the civil rights career and the political stuff, or you can, if all you really want to know is what on earth is going on in America and how does that reflect or contrast with different eras of history, that's primary. So, but the idea is, though, that they will sort of build on each other in a way. Dr. King's career from Atlanta to Memphis is the same career each time. Tonight, we'll look at it from the perspective of his life as a believer. Wednesday, from the perspective of his life as a civil rights leader, and we'll tell all the good stories about the civil rights movement. So if you're bored tonight, fear not, funny stories Wednesday. Friday will be the political aspects of it, but again, the same career three times. So any questions about kind of the lineup of things? I don't know if it's traditional to start with a prayer, but I'll feel weird if we don't. We're going to start with a prayer. Lord, thank you so much for this chance to be here tonight. Thanks for the rain. Thanks for the fires for the other people. Thanks for that awesome food we have tonight. Thanks for your name. So, when we meet King in his 20s and 30s, he is professionally a Baptist preacher. As he put it much later, in my being and my heart, I'm a Baptist preacher. I'm the son of a Baptist preacher, the grandson of a Baptist preacher, and the great-grandson of a Baptist preacher. That is my being, and that is my heritage. He says this in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement when he's known for many other things besides. But that's always how he saw it. Personally, he's a man of very, very deep faith. He would make decisions in prayer. He would explain his choices in explicitly But he doesn't start that way. So let's begin where he starts, which is a young boy growing up in his father's church, Ebenezer Baptist Church. His father was Michael King, who later became Martin Luther King. After he took a trip to Germany with a group of about 10 Baptist ministers, and he was so impressed by the life and career of Martin Luther that he changed his name from Michael to Martin Luther. So there's your Lutheran. And he changed his son's name, Martin Luther, then Michael King Jr., to Martin Luther King Jr. King attended his father's church, Ebenezer Baptist, basically every Sunday. As he later put it in a seminary essay, the church has always been a second home. He would go to church, not just at his father's church, but at some of the famous churches along the way, most notably the Wheat Street Baptist Church, where the Reverend William Holmes orders. Very, very well known in the 30s and 40s of Diamond. And King and his friends would love it when visiting ministers would come to town. They would sit up in the balcony as kids from time immemorial, including the only two kids here, good job, guys, would sit, and just see what the visiting preachers were up to. See how good they were at their craft. See what illustrations they were using, right? Just see if they were as good as Harrison Theater. And King said all of his classmates, basically, were churchgoers. Not that I chose them on that basis, he says, but because it was very difficult to find playmates in my community who did not attend Sunday school. So it was not just King, but that whole neighborhood in Atlanta, where everyone was going to church every Sunday. So what exactly is King hearing Sunday to Sunday as he's in church? This is an area where a huge part of American culture, the sermons of prominent black preachers in the 30s and 40s, has almost entirely vanished. It is very, very, very difficult to find recordings or transcriptions of even the most famous preachers for the African American church in that era. I had to get a King scholar to loan me his personal copy of the privately printed sermons of William Holmes Porter, which I took very good care of them, and spent every day at Dr. Mallet freaking out like spoke coffee on them. Because they're just like, these were not an object of general, put it this way, you didn't get the type of appreciation that in a properly run culture do. But we do have some sermons from Dr. Porter, some sermons from Dr. King, and we can see King grows up with four big beliefs. That God is a person, a father, in the parlance of that time, who loves him. Each person is inexpressibly worthy because they're made in the image of God, has dignity simply by being made in God's image. Third, you have to know God for yourself. You need to meet Jesus yourself. And fourth, the Bible does call us to do justice. So let's do one brief snippet on each of those. The personal God. There's a great William Holmes Borders speech, and Borders have a formal theological education, where he says, quote, God has been thought of as an impersonal power, a mechanized force, a stern judge, a first cause, and an unmoved mover and exacting law. You can hear the kind of theological school echoes, right? The Aristotelian echoes of that. But Jesus thought of God as Father. Man is bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh, blood of his blood, soul of his soul, spirit of his spirit. The second, the dignity of each person. This was something King would preach about with an illustration going back to the preachers from the days of slavery, who, as King put it, after a hard day's work, the slaves would often hold secret religious meetings. All during the working day, they were addressed with unnecessary vituperations and insulting epithets. But as they gathered in these meetings, they gained a renewed faith, as the old unlettered minister would come to his triumphant climax and say, you are not slaves. You are God's children. Third off, the importance of personal religious experience. King grew up hearing sermons that said you don't become a Christian just by going to church or by being the son of a minister. You become a Christian by meeting Jesus. So William Holmes Borders once heard another preacher preaching a trial sermon. Actually, a colleague just did. The colleague reviews this trial sermon. He says, quote, this young man has preached us a great sermon. I've never heard anybody say more about Jesus in my life. He really told us about Jesus, but he never told us that he met Jesus. I met him for myself. About religion is not religion any more than about Jesus. Fourth and last, the prophetic call to do justice. And this was obviously a major theme, familiar to anyone who is at Holden, but not necessarily familiar in every church in America then or now, that God calls us immediately to act in very common ways. And of course, in the sermons of Daddy King, which is how he was known publicly, and William Holmes Borders, it was often about race. So to take a Borders sermon, if God be God and religion be real, many Negroes, his word, will never see God's face in peace because of racial hate. If God be God and religion be real, many white people will never see God's face in peace because of racial prejudice. Can we meet in the heavens in God's throne over there when we can't meet at his feet on earth? This puts it forward. So that's what King is sharing in the sermon. We all know that's not all of what you hear about the Christian faith. So what's he hearing in Sunday school? Well, the answer there is not much. And this is not, you know, Sunday school then is probably like Sunday school now, where it is an area where the church perhaps does not pay quite as much attention as it might. And King is very critical. I mean, when he gets into seminary and graduate school, he just very dismissively talks about his Sunday school teachers as, quote, unlettered, close quote, who, quote, had never heard of him. And you read this guy, you're like, well, of course, right? I mean, like, who has a PhD in theology teaching Sunday school? Like, zero people. No one has that. But that, you know, the team is fresh in theological education, excited about the new learning he's taking on, and he's dismissive of what was going on in Sunday school. But then, you know, put aside the church part, what is King learning about being a Christian from his home? And this is where he writes very beautifully and candidly in a seminary essay called An Autobiography of Religious Development, which he writes in 1950. And he says, it was quite easy for me to think of a God love, mainly because I grew up in a family where love was central and where loving relationships were ever present. So that's where we read Cain from a child. He has these four big beliefs that he heard in sermon. He has very little in Sunday school, but he grew up in a loving home, which made it easier for him to believe in a loving God. That's where we are when he enters college at 15. He starts college at Morehouse when he is 15 years old, and he continues his theological education unbroken for some years. He goes to Morehouse, the Crozier Theological Seminary to Boston University, doing an MD at Crozier and a PhD at Boston. And it's an awakening for me. I don't know how many of you have had this experience, but it's not uncommon at all to have grown up in a very tight-knit Christian community, Christian home, and then be engaged with parts of the Christian theological or biblical tradition that are not identical to what you hold. A common hold. So that happens for Cain, starting at Morehouse. He gets to Morehouse and immediately is taking not just the standard liberal arts curriculum, but classes in the Bible, classes in theology. So what he says in that same essay is, quote, "At the age of 15, I entered college, and more I could see a gap between what I had learned in Sunday school and what I was learning in college. The conflict continued until I studied a course in the Bible, in which I came to see that behind the legends and myths of this book were many profound truths which one could not escape. My days in college were very exciting ones. It was at this period when the shackles of fundamentalism were removed from my body." When Cain says fundamentalism, it's not totally clear what he means by that. But what he means, at least, is not believing that biblical criticism, archaeology, textual studies are real, and taking a pretty strongly literalist approach to the Bible. So Cain gets to Morehouse, and he's like, well, can't do that. At least in his view, like, that's not going to work. Where are we going to go from there? So where Cain starts to embrace is what in the parlance of theological education of that day is called theological liberalism. That means, basically, is the way Cain heard it. Number one, sort of a scholarly approach to scripture, so biblical criticism, archaeology. And number two, looking at doctrines and believing that even if they did not literally happen, there was some symbolic meaning to them. And what Cain is learning, I mean, these are not like peripheral doctrines. These are doctrines that centralize the resurrection. So this is, you know, this is a liberal school of theology in northern, overwhelmingly white seminaries. But here's where things, to me at least, get really interesting. Cain does not just take over this whole new liberal tradition and say, ah, this is what I am now. I am now theological liberal, no resurrection, you know, yay, biblical criticism, hooray, hooray. Forget all this nonsense that I learned before. Cain keeps these four key beliefs from his childhood. You can see them over and over and over again in his seminary and graduate school essays, all of which I have read, and which are much better than anything that any of us wrote, particularly when we so he repeats the personal God, the need for a glory, the prophetic call to do justice, the dignity of work each person. And then for another, as Cain gets deeper and deeper into liberal theology, he starts to find it really unsatisfying in two key ways. First of all, he thinks the liberals are too optimistic about human nature. He fundamentally did not believe that we basically good, decent, well-meaning, loving, kind human beings would just get better if we kind of learn how to love each other. As he puts it in the seminary essay, quote, "Certain experiences I had in the South with a vicious race problem," close quote, "made it," quote, "very difficult for me to believe in the essential good of man." Instead, he says, quote, "Liberal theology has too easily cast aside the term sin, failing to recognize that many of our present ills result from sin." So that's his first big problem with liberalism. His second big problem with liberalism is, how are you supposed to preach it? I mean, if what you know is, well, let me tell you, this reading from the first reading is actually not written by whoever it says. It's written by this guy, and it's a collection of stories, and it's all myth. Good luck surviving under segregation. I mean, he knew immediately this was not something he could communicate to a congregation in a way that would be compelling. So that's where he leaves graduate school intellectually. is with the four key beliefs and pack a pretty strong critique of a very optimistic view of human nature and a question about how on earth he's going to synthesize and communicate what he's learned to a congregation in Scottish College. And he's also thinking to himself, I believe since I was a child in the need for a personal religious experience. Where's my experience? The closest he got, he writes in this spiritual development autobiography essay, was when he was five, was when there was a Kent meeting revival in town. His father brought everyone. His king sister went up when the altar call came and it came time to meet the Lord. And King at five was like, my sister's not going to be the only one who does this. And he follows her right there. He does the old call, everyone's happy. But that's, he knows, this does not count in his fear. Like, this is not the type of personal deep engagement with the Lord that he had heard about. So he says, how he reviews this book about religious experience and says, how I long now for that religious experience which this author so cogently speaks of throughout his book. It seems to be an experience the lack of which life becomes dull and meaningless. So that's where we are when King leaves Boston University and receives his first call to the Dex Rapid Baptist Church in Montgomery. He has been there for a very short time when the Montgomery bus boycott begins. We'll talk about that a little bit more, a lot more, on Wednesday. But for now, let's focus on what the bus boycott meant for Dr. King, spiritually. Unsurprisingly, the bus boycott was Paul. King faced death threats, regular, violent, strong opposition from segregationists in Montgomery, which is the majority of the white citizens in Montgomery. And he'd taken at that point to keeping a firearm in his home because something might go wrong and he wanted to be able to defend his family. So in the middle of the bus boycott, he has this experience that he would later talk about over and over again. I will never forget one night very late. It was around midnight. You can have some strange experiences. I had been out at a meeting all that night, and I came home. And my wife was in the bed, and I immediately crawled into bed to get some rest, to get up early the next morning and try to keep things going. And immediately the telephone started ringing, and I picked it up. On the other line was an ugly voice. That voice said to me in substance, uses a racial epithet here that tonight I don't feel like saying. We are tired of you and your mess now. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we are going to blow your brains out and blow up your house. I had heard these things before, but for some reason that night it got to me. I turned it over and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't sleep. I was frustrated, bewildered. And then I got up and went back to the kitchen. And I started warming some coffee. So you could have been thinking that coffee would give me a little relief. And then I started thinking about many things. I pulled back on the theology and philosophy I'd just studied in the universities, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence and the reality of sin and evil. But the answer didn't quite come there. I sat there and thought about a beautiful little daughter who had just been born about a month earlier. She was the darling of my life. I'd come in night after night and see that little child. And I sat at that table thinking about that little girl and thinking about the fact that she could be taken away from me anytime. And I started thinking about a dedicated, devoted, and loyal wife who was over there asleep. And she could be taken from me or I could be taken from her. And I got to the point I couldn't take it from her. I was weak. And I discovered then that religion had to become real to me. And I had to know God for myself. And I bowed down over that cup. Never would. And I prayed a prayer. And I prayed out loud. I said, Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right. I think the cause that we represent is right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And I can't let the people see me like this. Because if they see me weak, losing my courage, And it seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice saying, Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth. And lo, I will be with you, even until the end. King talks about this any number of times and tells exactly that story over and over and over for many years. There's a King scholar named David Garrow who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1987 for his biography of King, a person of no particular religious faith, who singles out this moment as the turning point in King's entire life. And for the rest of King's career, which again we'll go into in more detail on Wednesday and Friday, he sees himself as responding to God's personal, direct call. So when he's preparing for the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, we'll talk about more on Wednesday, his advisors give him a lot of ideas for the speech he would give back then. Finally, he says, my brothers, I understand. I appreciate all the suggestions. Now let me go and counsel with the Lord. In Chicago, in fall of 1965, a major campaign where, as it turns out, because the world is this small and God is this good, we have an expert in the Chicago campaign who is definitely not me, it's Seth McClellan, who's here, right there, who has done a documentary on King in Chicago. Seth and I were going to be doing a presentation together, but we couldn't quite get our acts together to do it. And by we, I mean me. I could not get my act together to do it. Because by the time I reached, Seth had reached out to you a month ago, by the time I reached back out to Seth and said, perhaps we should do something together, he's like, yeah, I already have my presentation. So I'm like, oh, I am the only one who's doing this at the last minute. So you should go see his non-King movies and then get his King movies. But there's a reason my Chicago campaign bits will be very short this week, because we have an actual expert in movement. But King in Chicago, King does this campaign in Chicago after many successful segregation campaigns in the South. All of his advisors almost unanimously say, this will not work. You will lose the support of white liberals in New York if you start attacking residential segregation in the North instead of the segregation of drinking fountains and bus stations and schools in the South. King says, this is where our mission is. We have received a call. In Vietnam, King speaks out against the war in Vietnam. King speaks out at the Riverside Church in New York against the war in Vietnam, not in Vietnam. And his advisors are like, why are you doing this? Like, of all the political losing causes you could choose right now, with civil rights to some extent already in trouble politically, why are you speaking out against this? President Johnson, who could not understand why this guy, Martin Luther King, who he had helped, in Johnson's view, with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which we'll talk more about on Friday, was suddenly not going to be with him on this Vietnam thing. Now, how come David is very Johnson, right, very transactional, like, I did this stuff for you, you got to help me with this Vietnam thing over here, this is where I need a little bit of help. And King would just say, oh, I want the kingdom of God on earth. You can't do it. I want the kingdom of God on earth. And Johnson, baffled, right? Not his language. King, in the late 1967, early 1968 period, and we're almost done, by the way. I know theoretically this was going to be an hour. I told everyone, look, there is zero chance I can talk for an hour, and I know no one's going to want to listen, so we'll end up the me talking part in just a couple minutes and then have some time for discussion. Folks can check out early. So King starts this big campaign in 1966, 1967, the Poor People's Campaign. It is meant to be a national march on Washington, D.C., of people from every race who did not have a lot of money, and people would just sit there in Washington, D.C., and as King said, camp out there until our demands are met. At the same time, there'd be demonstrations in cities all across. And King gives speech after speech after speech about how it's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but how about the New New York? How about the New Chicago? And what good does it do to wear golden slippers over there in yonder if I don't have anything on my feet to walk through this world? That is where he is. He's on a recruiting tour for the Poor People's Campaign in April of 1968, when he comes to Memphis to lend support to the sanitation workers' strikes. So the night of April 3, he is speaking at the Mason Temple in Memphis before a gigantic crowd to try to get more support, more momentum for this strike. He talks about all the successes of the movement, the Montgomery bus boycott, Birmingham, the moment in 1963 when he got up to, quote, tell America about a dream tonight. And then he says, well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up with God. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land. So I'm happy. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. So the next day, he's preparing for a dinner at the house of his friend, Reverend Billy Pines. And he's out on the balcony with Reverend Powell's field table. He spots Ben Branch, who will be playing saxophone, band saxophone player, at the meeting. And he says, I want you to play Precious Lord, Take My Hand. And you can know that, written by the Reverend Thomas Dorsey after he received news that his wife and his infant child. Cain says, I want you to play Precious Lord, Take My Hand tonight. Play it really. His driver yells at him to go in and put a tote out because it's cold. Cain says, okay, I will. And there's a clap. The Reverend Kyle says, sounds like a stick of dynamite. And they tinkle like this. So here's where we'll end tonight with one quick reflection. How many of you have been to the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C.? There's another one in my view, a better one in Atlanta, but the one in D.C. I'm not a big fan of this memorial, to be perfectly honest. The statue of King, I mean, you know, it's that tall, which in a theological sense is appropriate. C.S. Lewis writes somewhere about how one of the early theologians says that it's from Dante's Paradiso. In Dante's Inferno, when in the Paradise part, when the saints are in heaven, they look like mountains. So there's something theologically appropriate, right, of the giant king statue. But it's very blocky. You know, looks like it's a Leninist Soviet statue, honestly. He's kind of coming out of this solid wall of granite. So it looks a little, if you're me, like Han Solo in the Carmen, which is not maybe the appropriate reaction. The rest of the kind of granite behind him, just kind of here and there and coming all over. And then there are walls around the memorial where there are all these quotations from King's thought. And of course, the idea is you read these 16 quotations one after another and you get a kind of basic introduction to the fundamentals of what King believed. Well, guess what the one word is that does not appear in a single one of these quotations? God. So the quotations don't present King as you now know he was, professionally as a Baptist preacher, personally as a man of deep faith. They instead present him as someone who thinks that humans are basically nice, and we just love each other, we'll be okay. So you get, quote, hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that, close quote. Quote, we shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Quote, like, why does it bend towards justice? There are ideas there. So it's a mess, as you now know, exactly the opposite of what Dr. King did. He did not fundamentally believe that we are all basically well-meaning and kind. and that all we needed to do was try a little bit. He fundamentally believed that people would change only, and particularly in regards to the deep, deep sin of wickedness and wickedness of racism, with the aid of the transforming power of love. That's the right way to understand the I Have a Dream speech, which we'll talk more about on Wednesday. The dream is not that we will just, of our own accord, start to love each other. The dream is that God will deliver America. Or in the words of the prophet Isaiah, the king ends with, I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it. So there is your quick introduction to the spiritual life of the Father. Let's close with prayer. Lord, thank you so much for bringing us here again tonight. Thank you for giving us the example of Dr. Tony. Thank you for the way you spoke to us. Thank you for the way you spoke to us tonight. And Lord, we love you. And like James, the night before he died, we are not afraid. Feeling just somewhere fear not. And we fear not because, as we said to Dr. King so many years ago, you will truly be with us until the very end. Cut it off. Anything terribly out of your mind?
How did you get so interested enough not to do all this research, to read all these old sermons, and to write a book?
Well, thank you, Stacey, my husband. So, invariably, we would, this would be, I'd do this reading, that's my book came out, and the same thing would happen, finish the reading, dead silence, and my mom would go, okay, I have a question. So Stacey, thank you. You're the handsome family Christmas card on its way. So this was, for me, a law school project that got out of hand. I started in a course on the Civil Rights Movement and the Constitution, thinking about public memory of the Civil Rights Movement, and realized that, for me at least, as someone who was not black, not in the South, not from the movement, the dominant public image of the movement is the I Have a Dream speech. I started thinking, why is that? Why that speech and not some other speech? For that matter, why a speech at all? I mean, why is the dominant image a speech instead of the empty buses rolling through Montgomery, right, during the boycott? And so I got a sympathetic professor who sponsored this as an independent study and started kicking the tires on it. And the deeper and deeper I got into it, the more I realized sort of why and how and what. And I mean, I really do think there is a reason, and it's sort of many reasons set out at great length in the book, but we do remember this speech. It's not an accident. It's not just, this just happens to be, you know, one speech that could have been picked out of all of them because it was in Washington, D.C., nationally televised. That there is something to the power of the speech in King's delivery and the argument he makes, in the way the speech is resurrected after his death. Hi, sir.
I was wondering your personal thoughts and political thoughts about the book.
Great question. People hear that? Your personal and political thoughts on the current Poor People's Campaign. So, and we'll talk about this more on Friday, the quick version. As some of you may know, there's an effort to recapitulate the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. Under the leadership of Reverend William Barbarella. And there will be a big march on Washington and demonstrations in cities. I think it is highly unlikely to have any legislative effect for reasons similar to the reasons of the 1968 Poor People's Campaign failure. So now I don't hear it. Well, you're not leaving the village before Wednesday, leaving before Friday again. Or no, not Friday, Thursday. I'm sorry, Thursday. We're going to have an empty seat on Friday. Thursday, let's do that in great detail. But this is the types of problems that are being targeted by the Poor People's Campaign now and 50 years ago are not technically all that easy to solve and are very expensive. And when you have a national government that is not controlled by the natural sympathetic audience for the Poor People's Campaign, it is very difficult to see how this is going to resolve in, you know, a second law of poverty. In fact, it's not there. I'll tell you right now, as we all know. So, you know, we could have discussions about, are there other positive results of this other than a national statute or budget item, and there may be. That's the argument people make about Wall Street, by the way, which I don't know about the value thing. That even though Occupy Wall Street doesn't lead to massive banking reform, people say, it had tangible results in grassroots organizing that eventually gave birth to other people. So, come back here. Yeah, Abby.
When did you get in charge?
The question, if you didn't hear, was when did you get in charge? And the answer, as my kids never cease reminding me, is I am not in charge at all. But thank you. If what you mean is when did I get into politics, the answer was it is 7 years ago I got into politics. So thank you. That was a fabulous question. I am so not in charge. You should be in charge.
Was there anything in your research that really shook or changed your own spiritual life? Like anything about learning about King's spiritual life that really shocked or changed you or shifted how you look at things?
So nothing about, you know, King's prayer life or his sermons or his theological education, but as you probably similarly encountered, King's reasonably unquestioned record of unfaithfulness to his wife is a problem because it is a deep sin. And I was chatting back and forth with David Darrow, the King scholar I mentioned earlier, who spent 3 or 4 pages of his book just saying, okay, here we go. Here are the ways the King was unfaithful. I'm not going to hide it. This one happened. And so this is really tough. I was actually back and forth with Darrow this week about this. I was like, you listen to what he says. He's not lying, right? He does believe. He believes when he's writing. He believes when he's preaching. He met the Lord in Montgomery. But still, like, there's deep sin in his life. And of course, probably the answer is tons of deep sin in all of our lives, right? I mean, like, not sure that, like, our silliness or greed or narcissism or vanity or pride, just put it in pride, but my mind, are any particularly worse in the Lord's eyes than the way King said. But yeah, that's tough, right? That's a hard one. Yes, sir.
I think when we talk about King's religious beliefs, I think it's very important that we realize he died a very young man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suspect that if he had lived as long as some of us in this room have lived, he would have had further thoughts about his religious beliefs and may have, in his 70s, 80s, I wish he had lived that long.
Yes.
He may have looked at things much differently than he did when he was in his 30s.
Oh, I think that's exactly right, and a great point. I mean, what King wanted to do, when you read his private conversations, and we'll talk about why we get to do that in a couple of later sessions, but he talks all the time about how he'd love to just go be a dean at a theology school.
And I think
it's not a long career, be there 50, 40, 50, 60, and just think, to your point, how would his understanding of God have changed? Right? How would his relationship All right, anyone else? Sir.
Did King write all his own speeches or did he have to drop Kelly?
Almost entirely all of his own speeches. He was a jealous guardian of, even when he would get drafts from advisors, which he would do from time to time, the most important example of which is the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom speech. We'll do the whole backstory of that on Wednesday. But he would, you know, he would take a word here and a word there, and in fact, there's a place in here where I take the drafts he gets from his advisors and put them side by side with some of the drafts that he, with what he actually says. And you can see, actually you can't because it's a 9-point font, but on page 87 of my book, you'll be able to see, like, here's advisor one, here's advisor two, here's the little bit that he takes from both advisor one and advisor two. And then, when he's speaking, he makes the last round. So he he take little bits here and there. One of his theology professors said, all is grist that comes to his mill. But he always put the final authorship on his own. There is one important series of exceptions, which is labor history. So from time to time, King would have to give a speech before a union group. King knew zero about labor history. So King would ask Stanley Levinson, one of his advisors, typically, sometimes others, to draft a speech. And you can tell which ones the Levinson speeches are, right? Like here, John L. Lewis and the early CIO happened in such and such a movement. And it's, you know, it doesn't sound like King. So that would be the one exception. Yeah.
I didn't know.
Sir?
Did King always follow his notes on his speeches, or did he add what?
Well, thank you, Uncle Terry. That's a great question. He typically barely had notes. Most of the time, he would have a few words on the back of a church bulletin, because he's often speaking at church. Usually, those words are, here are the people I have to thank, and there's five names or ten names. And then there'd be a quick outline. But he would, by the time he's giving civil rights speeches, he's giving a couple hundred people, right? So he doesn't have time to write out a full sermon, a full speech every time. He has these speeches that he would give over and over again, sort of reassembled and combined in different ways. And the most famous example, which is Washington, where he has this prepared speech that he stayed up all night working on, that does not include the words.
I don't know quite what I want to ask or how to say it, but how does, I mean, you're a politician, you're trying to influence the way America is going to some extent, and you're in the public doing that. How does your spiritual life play into that? Do you think it's an asset for a politician, or I don't know, whatever you want to say, kind of along those lines.
That's a great question. So it is an asset in some parts of America. We have this Bible study prayer fellowship in the legislature. It meets every Tuesday morning. It is bicameral, it is both House and Senate. It's bipartisan, or at least it's nominally bipartisan. I'm a Democrat, and typically every Tuesday is 15 Republicans. We have like one or two more. And it's not that Democrats are not all people of faith, that would be false. What I say is the Democrats might be people of faith, but they're not morning people. Because it's a prayer fellowship at 7 a.m. So I tried to invite friends of mine who are believers on the Democratic side. They're like, I want to do a prayer breakfast. Can we do a prayer lunch? Maybe a prayer afternoon tea. Even with all of the things aside, like, look, it's not the Jesus stuff, not real big, at least in some parts of the Democratic side. And so that makes some of us a tolerant, I mean, I'm not going to say a tolerated curiosity, you know, right? But like, you sometimes kind of get that feeling. And just as it is sort of unusual. And again, not universally unusual. Obviously, the Poor People's Campaign is being led by the Reverend William Barber, right? Dr. King is the Reverend Dr. William Barber, one of the Southern Christian leaders, right? So in non-white circles, it's a lot more common than it is white. I don't know that it's, you know, it's funny though. I'm not sure it's an asset, it's just like a fact really, my being into Jesus is just sort of a fact of my political life. And it is noted because it is not all that common on our side of the aisle. So right after I got into office, I have this consultant who's helping in a very low-key way. And I said, Christian, how are we doing? Like, you feel I'm doing all right? And he goes, I think you're doing great. But every time you speak on the floor, it seems like you're speaking about Jesus. I'm like, you're welcome. I mean, what do you say? Like, I don't know. Yes, I'm speaking about Jesus a lot, all right? So in any event, like, it's sort of a, I don't know, an odd. Not an odd. It's not tough.
You work it into your speeches?
I don't work it. I mean, sometimes, yeah, I'm talking about Jesus stuff. Like, when we did, just like anything else, like, it is, I try to dial down the Jesus quite as much as I otherwise would, but, when we did, so we legalized marriage equality in Washington State in 2005, and I was, uh, I was asked to speak on the floor of brand new in the House because it was predicted, actually, that there would be a large voice presenting itself as a Christian voice against legalizing the marriage. And they wanted some Christian voice from our side. And the communications person from the House said, okay, you got to tell me what you're going to say. Like, new territory for us. You're a new member. We don't know you. Tell me what you're going to say. I said, it's going to be fine. I'm going to say, Jesus loves the gay. She's like, you can't say that. The Republicans will go crazy if you say that. No, don't worry. It's all going to be totally fine. So I talked about how my pastor had emailed me and said, hope you're voting for me. And how two people from my church, of course, from our church, you know, the choir director and one of the lead soloists, had got in touch with me independently and said, I hope you're doing that. And reminded people what many in this room and elsewhere know. We have a lot of gay brothers and sisters and siblings in the church. And had, maybe it is, but the Lord is leading me. And although, just so all of you from the other side listening know, this bill does not mean that your church has to bless me. It does not mean that. I have thoughts about that, which I've just shared with you. But this bill does not mean that. It deals with civil marriage and it is good. But I do want you all to know that as a Christian, I will be voting. So, Christian. Sorry, I was talking to Christian.
Recently, you've been privileged to hear John Lewis speak. Can you talk about his relationship with King and what kind of person you found him to be?
Yeah, so he. Congressman Lewis was, so the question was, recently had a chance to hear Representative John Lewis speak. So how many people know John Lewis? If that happened. John Lewis is the currently a member of Congress from Georgia, long serving, and the head for a time of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, one of the big early civil rights groups, beaten repeatedly in demonstration after demonstration after demonstration. He idolized Cain. He grew up listening to Cain on the radio. He was probably not a lot, but a little bit younger. He speaks at the March on Washington for Jobs and Cleveland before Martin Luther King does. And don't worry about buying my book, but one reason to look at my book while you are here is I reproduce all of John Lewis's speech at the March on Washington for Jobs, which is amazing. It is so great. And so you should just pick up my book. That should be your devotional time this week. Spend 10 minutes and read John Lewis's speech and ask how the Lord is speaking here. And he's, of course, like, you know, he is another one of the mountains that will one day leave heaven, right? I interviewed him for my book. Maria Campbell, our state senator, who I worked for briefly, introduced me to him. It's very kind of her. And I said, so, Congressman Lewis, we're here to talk about the March on Washington, your speech. Like, tell me a little bit. What's it like? And, you know, he's got so many other things in his career. He doesn't get asked about that a lot, right? And you could almost see him go back behind his eyes. And he said, well, I was nervous. I was very nervous. And I looked off over to my right, and there was a little knot of my friends from SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating, cheering and yelling. I thought, well, here it is. I just started to speak. And maybe I spoke too fast. I think maybe I spoke too fast. But you know, I was nervous and I had a lot to say. And then the speech starts. We march today for jobs and freedom, but we have nothing to be proud of, for many of our brothers and sisters are not. And he starts talking about the freedom activists who are in prison in the South, still, the day of the election. And it goes on. It is amazing. He was kind enough to say something nice about my book, which is on the cover. I'm just like, and we were on NPR together. We did very occasionally presentations together. So we did a presentation in New York that the New York Times put on, and it was John Lewis and Cornel West and me. I'm like, no! Like, one of these things does not fit. so we were backstage, and I was talking with Congressman Lewis and catching up, and Cornel West shows up, and he is raging. And he comes, and he's, you know, I'm not going to, Congressman Lewis, we're here. Cornel West walks in to that door, and he stops, and he points at John Lewis, and he gets down on his hands and knees and crawls 30 feet to John Lewis's feet, and he grabs it, and he gives him a hug, and he says, "Brothers, I know we are all equal in the eyes of the Lord, but this is Brother John Lewis," which is the only morally appropriate way. Anything else? 5 minutes to retrieve that first prayer. One more? Or zero?
At the speech, memorable line, he said this, I think I've been arrested for you sometimes. I might be arrested again.
Yes, and indeed, you will. It would be hard to say who's the most arrested, but a few people. Sir?
It's interesting. I don't have a question. But you presented a conundrum that King went through that I have felt and didn't know anyone else of that kind of experience. And being raised a Southern Baptist in the South, but not buying the theology of it at a very young age, went to baptism because I was tired of everybody pressuring me. But then joining the Lutheran Church as an adult and having the other conundrum, I recognized immediately when you said that, how about preach this? Mm-hmm. It's just a little thought and a little feeling I had that really hit home.
No, I'm out of love, right? And that's, so we, like I said, I haven't been back for 26 years, but the first day I'm back, which was yesterday, this woman grabs me outside the dining hall, and she goes, "Are you too handsome?" And it's nothing to do with, like, you know, this stuff. Like, it was, there may be five people from my childhood and older who I would know now. She's one of them. And so that's the Lord's grace. Like, 26 years, and we're both here the same way. And we're catching up. And she articulates exactly what you just articulated, which is that she grew up very, very, very conservative Christian, very conservative Christian college, conservative Christian school, and was introduced to science at some point in college. It was like, ooh. Where do we go from here now? And I told her, you know, Dr. King, you're in good company. Like, this happens to a lot of people, right? And I think I bet that is a very common holding doors, right? Very common holding doors. I think one of the beauties of this place, of course, is that it does allow you to meet Jesus. I'm sorry. Okay, I get to be extra Jesus-y tonight because we're holding this church camp. Like, this is not comfortable, familiar language with you all. Like, don't worry, this is the only super Jesus-y night. The other nights are not so Jesus-y. But this is, it's a place we get to meet the Lord in a pretty unique way that does embrace a lot of what King found compelling, his theological education, what you found compelling, while still maintaining the core of the Christian faith. When we were, so part of the oddity, part of the unusualness of being in Democrat politics is, like, from time to time you talk to other Democrats and be like, this is Christianity too, right? This is what, so I was talking to a very powerful figure in local Democratic politics one night. He goes, "Okay, I could be into Jesus if I knew your Jesus was the real Jesus." My Jesus is real Jesus. I mean, he's real Jesus. So anyway, the great part about Holden, right, is this is like the Rebel Alliance base for real Jesus. With that, thank you all. You've been very lovely.